Hello, and welcome to the Critical Voter Podcast. My name is Jonathan Haper, and before we get into the topic of the week, information literacy, I want to take a minute to explain why a subject that might seem more to belong in a technology or research class should actually be thought of as one of the foundational skills needed for critical thinking. If you recall, the series is based on something I refer to as practical critical thinking, an approach to the subject rooted in what some academics think of as the only purely American contribution to the philosophical tradition, the philosophy of pragmatism. Pragmatism holds that theory should be drawn from practice, from what works, rather than vice versa, an idea obviously influenced by how modern science develops its ideas. If you think about critical voter in this pragmatic context, we've been pulling from a number of different traditions at different times for different purposes. Modern cognitive science to look at bias, Aristotle when we talk about logic and modes of persuasion, the 20th century work of Toulmin to see how arguments can be diagrammed, Cicero to see how they can be organized, and so on. In each case, we've drawn from whatever source can most effectively help us master the subject or technique needed to move the project of using the 2012 election to develop our critical thinking skills forward. The reason information literacy, the study of how to find, assess, and use information, is such an important part of our pragmatic tool bag, gets back to the subject we introduced last week, background knowledge. It shouldn't come as any surprise when I say that background knowledge is a fundamental requirement for any intelligent discussion, debate, or analysis. For if you don't understand the subject you're talking about, no amount of logic or rhetorical skill can make up for that fact. You can't have a meaningful debate over the economy with someone who never heard of the law of supply and demand, for example. And if you don't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shia, then no syllogism or construct, no matter how artful, will help you understand the political dynamics of the Middle East. Now, there are two traps people fall into with regard to background knowledge. The first is the belief that just because they have read a few facts, such as those included in an opinion piece on a controversial subject, or looked up something on Wikipedia, that they have enough background knowledge to understand the matter under discussion. On the other end of the spectrum, many people view issues like the economy or international affairs as so complex that they are beyond any non-expert's ability to genuinely understand. Both extremes, either belief that you possess more background knowledge than you actually do, or the equally pernicious belief that there's too much background knowledge for you to ever understand anything, lead to the same place. Self-imposed ignorance. And believe me, there are lots of people who want you to do what they want, ready to fill this vacuum with their own often self-serving roster of experts. When faced with problems that exist on the extremes, I tend to turn to our old friend Aristotle, who, in his work on ethics, defined virtue as a golden mean between extremes. And in the case of background knowledge, this golden mean could be summed up by the word sufficiency. And what do I mean by sufficiency in the context of background knowledge? It's hard to create a cast iron definition of what constitutes sufficient or enough background knowledge, since this will vary depending on the topic and depending on what you need to do with this information. For instance, a single fact might be sufficient to settle an argument between roommates over who directed the latest American Pie movie. But if you're about to enter the courtroom to defend yourself in a lawsuit, sufficiency will probably consist of far more background knowledge, both of the law and of your particular case. Two of my favorite sources on critical thinking provide insights that can help guide you to determining thresholds for sufficiency in different situations. Kevin LaPlante from Critical Thinker Academy talks about the critical thinker as doing something similar to what actors do when they have to master a new role. For example, Hal Holbrook didn't have to earn a PhD in Mark Twain before he started portraying Twain on stage, just as Will Smith didn't have to write a dissertation on Muhammad Ali before playing him in the 2001 biopic Ali. But they did have to gain sufficient understanding of these real-life people in order to give a convincing performance. Even Benjamin Walker, who played Lincoln in that recent classic Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer, had to at least get the beard right. In the case of critical thinking, LaPlante argues that we must obtain sufficient understanding of the topic we are arguing and enough empathy with the people we are debating with to be able to articulate a credible description of our opponent's beliefs. Not a condemnation, not a parody, but a description that those opponents would agree accurately reflects their views. The Critical Thinking Foundation, a California group dedicated to critical thinking education, as another framework I find useful, a set of traits you'll find in a genuine critical thinker which includes the paired characteristics of intellectual humility and intellectual courage. In the context of background knowledge, intellectual humility requires that you admit, at least to yourself, that having sufficient knowledge is not the same thing as having comprehensive knowledge. There will always be holes in what we know, which is why we should be open to new information, not slaves to confirmation bias, and be willing to change our opinions as new facts become available and accepted. At the same time, intellectual courage requires us to make a stand if and when we think we have sufficient information to support our points. For while we should be aware of and open to the fact that new information might emerge that confounds our arguments, this should not cripple us or cause us to defer to others who claim to have all the answers. A claim that only demonstrates their lack of intellectual humility. So if background knowledge is our goal as critical thinkers and sufficiency the threshold we have to reach, where do we go and what do we do to gain the knowledge we need? Fortunately, there's a whole field of study that can help us on this quest, a field I mentioned earlier called information literacy. Information literacy, like media literacy, emerged in the 1970s before the advent of computers in the home, school, and workplace, which allowed its creators and practitioners to build an intellectual foundation that was ready to help us deal with the flood of information brought on by the computer and then the internet revolution. Information literacy actually emerged from the field of library studies. And if you think about it, this makes perfect sense. Since during the pre-computer era, outside of a home encyclopedia, dictionary, or almanac, most research and reference material was concentrated in a place dedicated to gathering information for widespread dissemination and use, the public or academic library. Historically, the information sources these libraries managed were printed documents, scrolls in ancient times, books, periodicals, manuscripts, and reference materials, either printed or stored on media such as microfilm in slightly less ancient times. But once computers, and just as importantly, valuable databases of information, often sold on CD-ROMs, came on the scene, the library was one of the few places that could afford to buy them for public use. As librarians began to manage larger and more complex sources of information, and as they struggled with their traditional book-collecting role in times of uncertain budgets, they reinvented their profession, turning from book and manuscript collectors and preservers into information specialists. And the field of study they created, information literacy, provided foundational definitions for the information skills we all need as those information sources expanded exponentially and entered our classrooms, homes, and the workplace via the internet. As I mentioned last week, information literacy can be boiled down to five key steps, or as I like to call them, canons. These include locating information, followed by evaluating information, followed by organizing, then synthesizing, and finally communicating information. But before you could begin on the first step of this journey, you must first have some kind of understanding of what you're trying to discover or learn. And the best way to do that is to form your quest into a question. For example, if you're dealing with some of the negative ads we've already analyzed in the Critical Voter podcast or blog, you might frame a question such as, was Mitt Romney responsible for the closing of the CST steel mill? Or, did Barack Obama demonstrate disinterest in the state of the private sector economy? These are just examples that tie into the theme of this podcast. But you could frame a question on any subject you're researching. If you're trying to discover something for school, you could frame it as a question like, how many U.S. presidents were unmarried? Or why is Pluto no longer considered a planet? Or if you need to make a decision at work, you might generate questions such as, how much will this product cost to implement and maintain? Or how long does it take a social media marketing campaign to produce results? The reason why you should frame your goal as a question is that every step you take in the information literacy process can then be evaluated based on how well it supports your ultimate purpose of having this question answered. The first step of this process is called locating information. And just as my generation would start by cracking open an encyclopedia to see if it contained an article on a subject, today most people start by punching the topic into a search engine such as Google, Bing, or Yahoo. And despite some of the criticisms I heaped on the internet last week, this is a perfectly valid place to start, as long as you keep in mind that these search engines will primarily be looking through what is called the open web. This open web contains all the websites you're most familiar with, Wikipedia, Facebook, YouTube, news and reference sites, commercial and school sites, etc. And while this open web is vast and may contain everything you need to achieve sufficiency, it might fall short, either because it doesn't have the information you need or the information you find there is of insufficient quality. Also, remember that there are other sources of information outside this open web. Most importantly, those library data resources I mentioned earlier are today more numerous and accessible than ever. Some of them can be accessed from home by anyone with a library card. And the library is still your best source of information that might not exist in digital format. In fact, one of the mistakes information illiterate people often make is to assume that if something doesn't exist in the form they could see on their computer screens, then it doesn't exist, or it's not worth finding. Finally, the internet, in addition to being an information source, is also a communications medium, which allows you to reach out to the scholars, journalists, and other experts who created the information you're looking for, or talk directly to participants by contacting people mentioned in a news piece to get their side of the story, for example. So while starting with a Google search is a perfectly reasonable first step in your journey, keep in mind that it's just that, a first step, not the beginning and end, unless you're trying to answer a trivial question such as who directed American Pie and exercise in simple information lookup rather than critical thinking. When I mentioned cracking open the encyclopedia a minute ago, I was describing a process similar to what you do when you perform an internet search, basing that search off of one or more key words. In the case of the encyclopedia, that keyword search might be limited to the name of a topic I'm researching, Pluto, U.S. presidents, etc. But one of the major advantages of internet search engines is the quick and comprehensive way they will search all kinds of variations of the keywords you specify. This also represents a downside of internet searching, as anyone who finds himself staring at 125 million search results knows. Because confronting those 125 million results is so daunting, we have a tendency to assume that what appears on the first page of search results represents the best information available. And in some cases, this is true, since programs like Bing and Google are built on sophisticated algorithms designed to push the most relevant and authoritative information at the top of a search ranking, while pushing less relevant information lower in the list. But some cases do not mean all cases. In fact, in many instances, the best material might appear on page 2, page 5, or page 100 of your list of returned search entries, which points out two important tasks with regard to searching. One, you can't just start and stop with your first selection of search terms unless you are very lucky or lazy, and two, you should spend time looking at more than just what appears on page 1. I met an instructor once who, when teaching information literacy skills to his students, asked them to refine and refine their search until it ended up with only one result. This is a useful exercise, at least with regard to demonstrating how thoughtful and creative use of keywords can help guide you to just the information you need. One doesn't necessarily need to go to this extreme with every search you do, although some skillful modifications of search terms can dramatically refine your results. For example, if I plug the words Mitt Romney and Bain Capital into Google, I end up with about 6 million results. But if I add the phrase CST Steel into the mix, I end up with a mere 180,000. But now look what happens when I put quote marks around the word CST Steel. Quotes tell Google to only find the words when they appear right next to each other rather than separated on the page. Doing this boils down my search from the original 6 million or 180,000 links down to just 72. Now this does not mean that those are the best 72 links in the universe on the subject of Romney, Bain, and CST, but it does mean that they are more likely to be talking about this specific subject than links that result from a less specific search. Continuing to look at ways to refine a search, not enough people take advantage of them, but search engines like Google and Yahoo have advanced options that let you specify far more search criteria than just keywords. For example, I'm looking at Google's advanced search screen that includes not just what terms to include, but what terms to exclude. And when might I want to exclude a term? Well, let's say you're searching for information on the planet, or former planet, Pluto, and want to skip any references to Pluto the Disney animated dog. In this case, my search term might be Pluto, but my terms to exclude can include Disney and dog. These advanced options also let you indicate that a search should only look through specific sources. For instance, let's say I want to find out what the Wall Street Journal has to say about the Obama administration's view on the state of the private sector economy. In that case, my keywords would be Obama private sector economy, but the advanced search field called site or domain, I specify WSJ.com, the domain of the Wall Street Journal. Advanced search options also let you search by when a site was updated, which can help you avoid stories that might be out of date. But another way to look for the most recent information on a topic is not to do a general search, but instead to do a search of news stories or blog entries, which lets you organize results chronologically from when the news story or blog post was published. You can also specify a date range to look only at stories published during a specific time. And when might that be helpful? Well, let's say you're looking into that Romney Bain CST story you've been using as an example. If you search current news sources using those keywords, you're most likely to get results related to the current controversy over this issue resulting from the presidential campaign. But if you limit your results to just 1 year, 2001, the year CST filed for bankruptcy, you might find information such as articles and financial publications that talk about the story from a perspective not influenced by current politics. I've also been talking about well-known general search engines, Yahoo, Bing, and Google. But keep in mind there are also search engines dedicated to specific topics such as medicine, history, or astronomy. And many of these may have their own algorithms and sources for locating information, which may be different than those used by the big three, meaning may get better or at least different results based on the type of search engine you use. There also exists something called meta search engines such as Dogpile or WebCrawler that will run your search terms through many search engines at once, saving you from having to perform multiple searches separately. Links to some of these specialized and meta search engines appear on the Critical Voter Resources page. We spent a bit of time talking about how best to craft your initial search, but keep in mind that no matter what search engines you use and how well-defined your search terms, the results of a search should be just treated as step one in your quest for sufficient information to answer your question. Step two might include looking through the websites you found in that initial search for links to lists of additional relevant information. Many websites, including the Critical Voter site, have resource pages, blog rolls, and other lists of links that point to material the creator of the site thinks are important or relevant. And like the results of a Google search, these links were not generated automatically, but were selected by a person informed and interested enough in a subject to create a website on the topic you're researching. Scholarly articles may also include live footnotes, that is, footnotes which link directly to the source they came from, giving you immediate access to the sources the author used to perform his or her research. But what do you do if the footnote isn't live, but refers instead to a journal or other resource that isn't online? Or what if someone's resource page points you to a book or newspaper that isn't available on the internet? Well, this is where you've got to shut down the computer, get out of your chair, and head off to the library where they still maintain or can obtain information that has not yet been digitized. And even on the digital front, as I mentioned earlier, many libraries provide access to databases of articles, journals, and other information you can't find on the open web, most of which go through far more quality control than online sources such as Wikipedia. So time spent repeating your searches on specialized databases available to you via your library or library's website is time well spent. Finally, don't forget that the internet is as much about communication and collaboration as it is about searching and consuming information created by others. Somewhere out there, there is likely to be a person doing research similar to the work you are doing. And it's more than likely that the human beings who created the websites you are discovering, especially those that include a contact page on their site, are eager to hear from you. As someone who maintains such a site, I can't tell you how exciting it is when someone actually clicks on that contact link and sends me a request for information. So not only are experts out there who know what you're trying to discover, they're often dying to communicate with you and help you answer your questions. Okay, I've spent a fair amount of time on locating information, but I believe this is worth this amount of coverage since honing your search skills can mean the difference between obtaining sufficient background knowledge to think critically versus becoming a victim of information overload. But the next step in the information literacy chain is just as important, evaluating the information you find for quality. And what do I mean when I say quality? Well, for each source you discover, you need to know whether you can trust the information it provides to help answer your original question. And before you decide to trust or distrust a source, you need to be aware that there are many ways information from any source can be problematical. For example, an information source may be biased in that it only provides information on one side of an issue or treats information on one side differently than it does the other. As we talked about last week when we discussed media literacy, some sources are easy to identify as biased. For example, you would not check out the Obama for President website for balanced information on Mitt Romney's economic plans, nor would you look at the Republican National Committee site for an unbiased perspective on President Obama's time in office. As for traditional news services, some of these wear their biases on their sleeves, while others claim to offer impartial coverage with a wink to their real audience, which are partisans on one side or the other. But a bulk of traditional news sources claim, and probably believe themselves to be, 100% fair and balanced. And I'm afraid it's up to you to decide where you feel the news sources you like to read, listen to, or watch fall into the spectrum. But I can highlight that there are some information sources which define their product offering specifically around political impartiality, which makes them worth adding to the mix. For instance, the website factcheck.org uses the tools of journalism to examine claims each candidate makes in a speech, TV ad, or debate performance. And a site I particularly like, called procon.org, provides extensive documentation on both sides of various controversial issues. As for your average everyday blog or other site unaffiliated with a news service or organization you can identify, are there ways to identify their potential bias? Well, there are some information literacy tricks that can help inform your judgment. For example, does the site go out of its way to acknowledge alternative opinions or opposing views ignored or ridiculed? Does the site link to external sources, including external sources with various views on an issue? Or do links on the site only point to other pages on the same site, or only to sites of the like-minded? Does the author of the site use intemperate language, either in their own postings or in their response to comments criticizing their opinions? All these are telltale signs of potential bias. Keep in mind that you should not flush all information from a source just because you suspect that source is biased. But you do need to understand the types and levels of bias a source might be bringing to their presentation analysis, and at least assume that such sources may not be providing balance and could potentially be providing you with inaccurate information. But inaccuracy does not just originate from bias. In fact, it can come from any number of places, such as tight deadlines, carelessness, or simple human error, which is why a test for accuracy is another important component of evaluating information. Ironically, bias can actually help us gauge accuracy, since if biased sources on two sides of a debate both agree on certain facts, that's a good sign that these facts might be true, or at least that two disagreeing parties accept them as a reasonable starting point for argumentation. For the most part, however, the test for accuracy simply involves the shoe-leather work of double or preferably triple-checking your facts using multiple independent sources, much like a journalist is supposed to do. Other tests for information quality include timeliness. Is the information up to date? As a simple example, if you're researching why Pluto is no longer considered a planet, material published before 2006, the year Pluto was kicked out of the Planet Club, may not be timely. Some of the methods we mentioned earlier for searching for information within a date range can help you weed out sources that might be time-sensitive or out of date. And if you're researching any fast-changing story like breaking news or rapidly changing a field like technology, you should always check for the latest stories on these subjects to make sure any information you've found has not yet been superseded by more recent events. Another test is for relevance. Does the information relate to the question you're trying to answer? For instance, if you're trying to find out which presidents were unmarried, stories of their childhood and campaigns might be interesting but not relevant. Similarly, if you want to determine what President Obama has done to help small businesses, information on his bailout of the major auto companies may or may not be relevant, depending on which questions you are trying to answer. As I mentioned earlier, search engines do their best to try to rank results based on relevance to the keywords you specified, which makes it doubly important that you get your search terms right. And as with all the tests we've described for evaluating information, you need to use your own judgment to determine whether or not information you have found moves you forward to your ultimate goal of answering the question you posed at the beginning of this entire process. Sufficiency, having enough information, is also one of the tests we use to evaluate information. And as we've already talked about, our ultimate goal for the entire evaluation process is to ensure that enough information you've located passes our various quality tests to allow us to move ahead with the information literacy process. I'm going to give the last three steps in that process, organizing, synthesizing, and communicating information, a little less time, partly because I'll be talking about them further on the blog this week, but partly because they can vary widely depending on what the goal of your research might be. Regarding organization, once you've located and evaluated the information you need, you must now organize this high-quality set of resources in a particular way. For example, if you're creating a bibliography to go at the end of an academic paper, this organizational structure would be alphabetical. But if you're trying to create a timeline of who did what when on your website, then information needs to be organized chronologically. You can also organize information thematically, by a subtopic of your original topic, for example, or into a hierarchy, such as information derived from what you believe to be the most versus the least biased sources. The purpose of this organization effort is usually to help you create something new from this information, which educators call a work product. Examples of work products include a term paper, newspaper article, blog posting, or video. And the process used to create this work product involves synthesis, using the information you have located, evaluated, and organized as building blocks to create something that previously did not exist. Finally, we get to communication. In our hyper-communicative age, we usually don't keep our work products to ourselves, but instead share them with others, either one-to-one, by emailing a term paper to your teacher, for example, or one-to-many, by publishing your story on a website where it can be read by anyone on the planet. And this is where the five canons of information literacy come full circle. Once you've communicated the work product that is a result of all that locating, evaluating, organizing, and synthesis we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes, you need to assume that others will go through the same process to evaluate the quality of what you have created, which means that at every step of the information literacy process, you should remain cognizant of the fact that the same standards you've applied to others, accuracy, relevance, timeliness, lack of bias, etc., are going to be applied to you. I was hoping we'd have time to walk through an actual example once I've finished walking you through all the five canons of information literacy, but given the time, that walkthrough will have to wait until next week. But before signing off, I'd like to jive in a few minutes on why I chose to refer to the canons of information literacy, rather than use more contemporary terms like elements or components. The use of the term canons is obviously meant to harken back to the five canons of rhetoric I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago, which specify the way arguments are organized through invention, also called discovery, arrangement, memory, style, and delivery. The reason I think of information literacy as also broken into canons is not just because there's also five of them, location, evaluation, organization, synthesis, and communication, but because there's almost a perfect match between the two sets of canons I just listed. For what is invention and discovery if not another way of saying locating and evaluating information? And is there any difference between the notion of arrangement and the information literacy concept of organizing information? Style, memory, and delivery don't represent quite as perfect a fit, but certainly everything contained in those ideas can be described as a form of synthesis and certainly communication. In other words, we seem to be looking at a surprising parallel between information literacy, which, as I said, is a field just a few decades old, and a cornerstone of classical thinking that goes back more than two millennia. Now, this might just be some sort of historical or intellectual coincidence, but I suspect it's more than that. For there's one thing that we today have in common with those who lived thousands of years ago, which has to do with the notion of the library, an institution that's been mentioned several times during this podcast. It was in the classical age, after all, that the world's knowledge was held in the great libraries of cities like Alexandria, Athens, and Rome. And during this era, it was not a stretch to say that a large percentage of what constituted human knowledge was stored in one of these facilities. Not all of it, of course, but a higher concentration than had ever been known before. And so, the quest for answers to important questions required an understanding of how to find and use information located in one of these great libraries. During the centuries that followed the end of this classical age, knowledge didn't disappear, but it was no longer so concentrated. Libraries, universities, monasteries, even people's homes in cities and towns across the world became places where smaller bits of knowledge were collected, stored, added to, and used. And as this amount of knowledge in the world dramatically increased, more storehouses of information appeared in more locations, meaning the world's growing body of knowledge is being distributed over an even wider area. Now, people could still share information they had stored in their own warehouses or in their own heads, but this communication involved hauling paper by horse-drawn carriage, then ship, and finally the automobile and airplane. And even when the computer disk replaced the paper manuscript, and overnight delivery meant the movement of physical manifestations of knowledge could be done in 1 or 2 days versus 1 or 2 weeks or months, intellectual activity was still about bridging islands of knowledge separated by time and space. Today, however, we've eliminated barriers, as well as begun the greatest project in the concentration of human knowledge ever attempted, with both this elimination of barriers and concentration of information facilitated by the same technological breakthrough, the internet. Today's internet may contain thousands, perhaps millions of times more information than was ever stored in the great libraries of the past. But the world we inhabit today, at least in terms of where information can be found, is more similar to when those libraries stood than in any era in between. And that's because for the first time in 15 to 20 centuries, we have returned to a world where information is concentrated, not dispersed, and accessible, both to take from or add to, through a new Library of Alexandria of the web. Given this transformation, is it any wonder that the principles codified thousands of years ago to help people find and use information have returned to prominence today? So with respect to information literacy, I think it's worth asking if we have created something new or rediscovered something very old. And if a mix of wisdom and tools from today and from millennia ago can help turn us into skilled, empowered users of modern inventions like the internet, what else might they do for us? Might this mix of cognitive science and information literacy, Aristotle and Cicero, be able to help us use this great bounty of information to think critically and thus truly understand the world? It'd empower us to think on our own two feet and thus be truly free. I'm betting on it, and I hope you will too by joining me for the next Critical Voter podcast.